Thanks very much. Very happy to be here. So the star of this talk is going to be the black hole membrane paradigm. I'm interested in the membrane paradigm for two reasons, really. One reason I find the membrane paradigm interesting is it seems to have some deep connections to ideas in physics, things like holography and ADS-CFT. The second reason that I'm interested in the membrane paradigm is that it's just very useful in a practical sense for calculations in astrophysics. So I'm going to talk about both of those things in this talk a little bit, especially how it's been very useful for understanding this astrophysical problem of black hole jets, how these jets extract black hole rotational energy. And my hope is that maybe because the membrane paradigm appears and is related in these very two very different contexts, my hope is that eventually it could be a link that leads to more interactions between astrophysics and fundamental physics. So here's an outline of the talk. I'll start by just reviewing what the membrane paradigm is. Then I'll discuss how the membrane paradigm has been very useful in this astrophysics problem of understanding black hole jets, how the jets are powered, where, and how they extract black hole rotational energy. And then, as I mentioned, there's this hope that maybe because the membrane paradigm is related to some things in fundamental physics, like ADS-CFT, and because it shows up so much in astrophysics, maybe there's opportunities for more interaction between the two sides. And so I'll talk about some recent work where I've tried to kind of push on that idea and see if I can actually realize it. It led me to think about this old astrophysics problem related to something called the black hole Meissner effect. And I think I can argue that some new ideas coming from physics have been useful for gaining insight into this old astrophysics problem. Okay, so that's the outline. So to start off, let me motivate sort of one way you might arrive at the black hole membrane paradigm. So this picture on the left is supposed to indicate a Penrose diagram of a black hole space-time. Is this really my pointer? All right, good. Okay, so here's the black hole exterior and the interior. There's a horizon here. And I want to think about an observer who spends their whole life outside the black hole and never jumps in. So an example of such an observer is any astrophysicist. Because astrophysicists go to and from their telescopes, they study all these black holes in the sky, but they never actually jump in. So this is a picture relevant to, say, an astrophysicist. And the thought is that this observer can never get signals from the black hole interior. And so they might like to try to do all their calculations without ever referring at all to the black hole interior. There's some indications that when you think about the space-time quantum mechanically, you might be forced to do your calculations without referring to the black hole interior. But the idea going forward is let's try to formulate all of this observer's calculations without using the black hole interior at all. And so the first idea is, okay, I'm just going to throw away the black hole interior, and I'm going to do all of this observer's calculations on this truncated space-time that just ends at the horizon. But if you do this in the most naive way, you'll find some inconsistencies. On this truncated space-time, the laws of physics won't quite work the way they're supposed to. So you patch things up by putting a membrane at this new boundary that you created at the horizon when you threw away the black hole interior. And you define the membrane just right so that all exterior physics is reproduced correctly.
I'm sorry, what way is that? So if this is a null surface?
Yeah. So on the next slide, I'm going
to
give a really concrete example of how this works and why you sort of need it. So here's a simple example. Suppose you have a black hole threaded with an electric field. This is kind of the picture you'd draw if you were an infalling observer. Now I want to think about this guy who stays outside the black hole forever, throws away the black hole interior, says, I don't want to talk about it at all, runs into a problem. And that the electric field line begins and ends on the horizon. And the Gauss law, the Gauss constraint, says electric fields are only supposed to begin and end on charges. And so the way you patch this up is you define a membrane on the horizon, and you define the electric charge density of the membrane to be the normal component of the electric field evaluated at the horizon. And so you say there's these electric charges sitting there, and this is how they're defined. They terminate the electric field. You couldn't localize a charge on the horizon. Yeah, so generally these aren't individual charges. This is some charge density distribution on the horizon defined by this formula. And so one question you can ask is, these charges look pretty fictitious. We just put them in by hand to patch up this problem. You can think about the same thing from the perspective of an infalling observer who jumps in the black hole. Of course, when they fall through the horizon, they're not actually going to see any charges there. So the way this is usually framed is we say we put some fictitious charges on the horizon to make physics look okay to the exterior observer. It's a little more subtle than that, because if this guy who jumps in gets to the horizon and says, aha, there's not actually any charges here, that was just a trick that you did, it's too late for him to send that message to the guy who stayed outside. So as far as the guy who stayed outside is concerned, the membrane looks awfully real. And this principle of black hole complementarity has been formulated that says, in some sense, they're both right as far as whether or not the membrane is real or fictitious. So the way I defined the membrane a couple slides ago, it was sort of this ad hoc thought experiment. And in the 70s and 80s, that's sort of how the whole membrane paradigm was worked out, in a series of these ad hoc thought experiments, trying to figure out what properties this membrane has to have to make physics look okay without a black hole interior, without having to refer. Again, because you can't actually get signals from there, it's sort of conceptually cleaner if you can do all your calculations without referring to the interior. In 1998, Frank Wilczek and Parikh came up with a very nice general definition of the membrane paradigm at the level of actions and Lagrangians, which makes everything very elegant and very mathematically rigorous. And so let me take this as a definition of what the membrane paradigm is. So let me just review their definition. They consider some theory on a black hole spacetime defined by some Lagrangian and some action. And normally when you'd evaluate this action, you'd integrate the Lagrangian over all of spacetime. But then they say, think about these observers who stay outside black holes forever and never jump in. Those observers would prefer to restrict this integral just to the black hole exterior. Since they can't get signals from the interior, why would they integrate over it? And so they might work with this new action, S exterior, the same as the first one, except the integral is restricted to the black hole exterior. And they try to do all their physics with that action. But they run into some problems. When they try to compute the equations of motion by varying the action, they get a different variation than they got originally when they used the full thing. And the reason is because whenever you vary these actions, there's always a step where you integrate by parts and get these boundary terms. Normally you say, well, the boundaries are at infinity, and you throw these boundary terms away. But when there's a horizon sitting at some edge of your spacetime, those boundary terms start to matter. And so they mess up the agreement. And so the way you want to fix that up is take that exterior action, S exterior, and add some new terms to it, supported just on the boundary. And you choose those terms just right so that S exterior agrees with the action you'd get if you had used the whole spacetime. And so as an example, when you plug in the Maxwell Lagrangian and think about electrodynamics, the boundary term that you need to add to S exterior is this thing, supported. It's just supported on the horizon. It involves this current J, which is defined in this funny way, where you take the electromagnetic field strength in the bulk, you evaluate its normal component in one of the indices, and you evaluate it right at the horizon. And that gives you a notion of this current that just lives on the membrane. And the time component of this current is just the charge density that I kind of arrived at in this ad hoc cartoon earlier. The time component of that is just going to be the normal component of the electric field evaluated at the horizon. But it contains more as well. There's also these spatial components, which are an honest current flowing around this membrane. And so this gives you a nice systematic way of figuring out all of the properties of the membrane. You can do the same thing, but instead of the Maxwell Lagrangian, put in Einstein Hilbert and think about gravity. And you find out that the membrane you need has a stress energy tensor. Yep.
So far, the membrane is just a null surface, right? There's nothing about it being a vectorized, you know, singularity inside or something.
Yeah. So it's just a null surface to the extent that it sits on the event horizon. A couple comments. Everything I've done in the previous two slides, you can do on any surface, really. But the horizon has this extra special property that signals from beyond it don't reach you. So that's what makes it the natural surface where to do this. Another thing that you might be wondering is, yeah, I've just done everything on the horizon. There's an extra step in the membrane paradigm that I wasn't actually going to mention, where you switch to a stretched horizon, sitting some epsilon above the true horizon. And as far as I'm concerned, the reason you use the stretched horizon is really just a technical reason. The metric, if you take the metric and you restrict it to the horizon, because the horizon's a null surface, the metric is degenerate. And so calculations just are easier if you move to a time-like surface, the stretched horizon, a little bit above the event horizon. Do your calculations there on this time-like surface. And then at the end of all your calculations, take the limit that the stretched horizon becomes the true horizon. Yeah, so that's this technical extra step that people usually do. But conceptually, yeah. Okay, so this brings up a good...
The first example of the charge was like the charge involved the gravity, right? So
yeah.
It's kind of simple because the background is fixed. But here, if you use actually then the background is not fixed.
Yeah. So this is an excellent, excellent point. So, I think the previous two slides make it pretty clear that the membrane paradigm, if an external observer uses the membrane paradigm, they will in principle correctly predict all experiments correctly, because it's just defined to be the thing that reproduces all exterior observations. What it doesn't address is how practical it actually is to use this formalism. And you've hit on one of the reasons it can be very impractical. I wasn't going to mention it, but let me mention it now. The event horizon is this funny teleologically defined surface. To know where the event horizon is, you have to know the full future history of the space-time and trace the event horizon backwards. And because of that, the membrane paradigm inherits all of these funny teleological properties. So for example, if you torque a membrane to extract its energy, you find that energy starts to flow out of the membrane before the torque is applied to it. Okay, so that makes actually working, that can make actually writing a computer code that solve the membrane paradigm in some way, it would be very difficult. So what I'll do in this talk and what people normally do is they don't actually use the membrane paradigm for their computer codes. They want to solve some GR problem. But what I do find is that at the end of the day, once you have the full answer, you can translate it all to this membrane formalism, and often that's very illuminating. Yeah, essentially, exactly, yeah. And so some people think that's a bug and they avoid, there's some people who have very strong feelings about the membrane paradigm. Some people think that, there's some other caveats I could mention. They think those are bugs and then they refuse to touch it. Other people, like I think some of these funny features in the membrane paradigm could be hints about, you know, some interesting physics. Like there might be a lesson there, some kind of lesson that hasn't been fully understood. Right, so the membrane paradigm has this nice property that the mass and angular momentum of the black hole are stored in the stress energy tensor of the membrane. So on a practical level, this is very useful for understanding black hole jets, because it gives you a very concrete picture of where the rotational energy is. And so you can get a very concrete picture of here's the rotational energy initially, and you can just watch it being drained out into the jet through some torques, which I'll get to. So I'm going to move to the astrophysics problem in a moment, but I want to mention that other motivation I said, which is the connections to fundamental physics. So all of this starts to look a lot like ADS-CFT. This whole membrane paradigm was worked out in the 70s and 80s, but it sounds very modern, actually. On a qualitative level, the cartoons are very similar. So membrane paradigm, I said I want to throw away the black hole interior, and I want to replace it with a theory living on the boundary, on the horizon. And of course, in ADS-CFT, you say, OK, I'm going to just throw away the whole space-time and replace it with a theory living on the boundary of that, CFT. But even at a quantitative level, there's a lot of similarities. For example, in ADS-CFT, a gauge field in the bulk is dual to a conserved current on the boundary. And the formulas that relate the two are essentially the same as the formulas that I showed a few slides earlier for figuring out the dual membrane current from the bulk gauge field. And so my hope, but over the past few years, ADS-CFT have been pushed a lot further. So membrane paradigm is essentially this classical thing. ADS-CFT, we now understand much beyond the classical realm. We understand it, understand it quantum mechanically. So my hope is that all these great advances and insights in this context will eventually help us get a better understanding of things like the membrane paradigm. And because that's so useful for astrophysics, maybe lead to some astrophysics results. Connect the two. So let me show you why the membrane paradigm is so useful for astrophysics. This is the system I have in mind. This is a black hole X-ray binary. There's a black hole here. It's being orbited by some ordinary main sequence star. And it's pulling material off the star into this accretion disk. The accretion disk gradually spirals onto the black hole. This region gets very hot and is emitting primarily in the X-rays. X-ray telescopes can look at this region and figure out how fast the black hole is spinning by fitting disk models to the emission. There's about 30 of these that have been found in the galaxy. About 9 of the black holes now have very reliable measurements of how fast they're spinning. The spin measurements show a broad distribution. There's a couple that almost aren't spinning at all. There's a couple black holes that have intermediate spins. And then there's a couple that, for all intents and purposes, are right up at the extremal limit, spinning as fast as they're allowed to. The black holes themselves are of order 10 solar masses, about 10 kilometers across. And all the typical timescales in that inner region are microseconds. Of those 9 black holes that have very reliable spin measurements, a few of them are also seen to be launching these energetic jets along their polar axes. There's measurements now where people have gone out over the past couple years, and they've measured the power in those jets. And then they did the obvious thing and plotted against how fast a black hole is spinning. And sure enough, there's this trend where the more rapidly spinning black holes have the most powerful jets. There's been theories of how these jets form since the 1970s, but only now can you confront these sorts of theories with data. The data is noisy. There's only a handful of points. But it's consistent with this old idea that jets are powered because they extract the rotational energy of the black hole. And so what I'd like to do is dig into this problem a little deeper and understand how that process works and refine our models for future observations.
Can I ask a question about that? So you were saying that they have reliably measured spin. These are the ones that are, these are not the ones that are being measured with Iron Tail.
No.
They're being measured by, this is like Narayan.
Yep, exactly.
I thought that a worry there was that their key thing there is that they're modeling the disk as a thin disk.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's this simple analytic model for how the disk emits.
Let me mention that. Let me see some comments about that. I mean, those measurements on the x-axis, that's easily a talk in itself. And as you said, there's two different ways of measuring the spin. One is to you see an iron line, and you try to figure how fast it's spinning from how relatively broad the line is. Lots of assumptions go into those measurements. There's this other method, which is much simpler, which is you wait for the disk to enter a state where its spectrum is basically just a black body. And then there's very simple disk models you can fit that tell you the spin given the temperature of the black body. And so I could give a talk. So my PhD thesis is all about these disk models. And the point is that the thing that you're actually measuring when you do a black hole spin measurement is this. So these accretion disks don't extend all the way down to the black hole. They have some inner edge at the ISCO. This is the innermost stable circular orbit. And so this is just something you compute from the circular geodesics of the Kerr metric in a GR class. And what you find when you compute it is that the ISCO is a strong function of spin. This is the radius of the ISCO. But this assumption that the disk has a strong, sharp inner edge at the ISCO is only true for certain disk models. And these disk models are analytical, and so there's been a lot of controversy about whether this is a good assumption. So short answer is, you do the same simulations I'm going to show in the next couple of slides. You vary disk parameters, and you find that for a certain range of disk parameters, this assumption is fine. Basically, you need a disk that's emitting below 30% of the Eddington limit. So it can't be too bright. As long as you only use that data with this property, you're okay. Like we now have simulations that show that. And sure enough, when they do these measurements, they're careful enough to select their data to have this property. So we have a really good understanding of this now. Yeah, it's basically the short answer. Yeah. Okay. So this system is depicted on the left. So you have an accretion disk, black hole, this jet. It's a pretty messy system. So computer simulations have been very useful. The accretion disk itself is turbulent, it's magnetized, it's intrinsically three-dimensional. So the computer simulation I've been using is a general relativistic magnetohydrodynamics code called HARM, which a number of people wrote. And what we do is we solve the three-dimensional magnetohydrodynamics equation in a fixed Kerr background, so Kerr metric space-time of a spinning black hole. And just to give you a feel for what these simulations can do before I turn to the membrane paradigm interpretation of what's going on. Let me show you a movie. So this is the initial condition that we start with. We start with a black hole surrounded by a torus of gas. So here's, I'm taking a slice through the torus. So here's the black hole, and there's this ring of gas extending around. And this torus is in hydrostatic equilibrium. So if I left it alone, it would just rotate around the black hole forever, happily. I don't let it do that, though. I also thread it with some magnetic fields. So here's these loops of poloidal magnetic field that are sitting in the torus. So here's magnetic energy. The initial magnetic field is weak. Its pressure is just like 1% of the gas pressure. And what will happen when I start the simulation is the magnetic field will get sheared out by the differential rotation of the fluid. And that's known to be unstable. There's something called the magnetorotational instability. The instability develops and saturates. That causes the thing to become turbulent. Turbulence has this magical property that it transports angular momentum outwards. That causes gas to accrete inwards and form an accretion disk. And if you make the disk thick enough, you get jets. There's also this sort of halo of gas around the black hole. That's just an artifact of the initial conditions that'll fall onto the black hole early on, and you can just ignore it. So let me play this. So what you see in the movie early on, the bottom plot is more interesting. The field is getting distorted as it gets sheared out, and you're seeing the linear growth of this MRI instability, magnetorotational instability. Eventually, the instability saturates. The thing becomes turbulent. Turbulence is transporting the momentum outwards and allowing the gas to accrete inwards. So eventually, this region in here where there is no gas is going to fill up with this accretion disk accreting onto the black hole. And then we can zoom in on this and understand properties of the accretion disk and of any jets that form. So in this particular simulation, the black hole has a spin of 0.98. So it's almost at the extremal limit where the black hole is spinning at the speed of light. At the end of the day, you end up with a turbulent disk. Magnetic fields are buoyantly rising out of the disk, and so you get this highly magnetized laminar corona above and below the disk. All sorts of really interesting phenomenology in here. Now, if I repeated this simulation with a thicker accretion disk, I would find that around this stage, jets spontaneously turn on. To actually see the jets, you wouldn't really want to look at these quantities. They show up best if you plot Lorentz factor. So here's a similar simulation. There's still an accretion disk, but because this is a plot of Lorentz factor, you don't see it. It's sitting here, but its Lorentz factor is small enough that it doesn't show up in the plot. I've zoomed out to some really large scale so that the black hole is just a pinpoint here. And then you see this really highly collimated outflow with a Lorentz factor around 4 along the spin axes of the black hole. And this just developed spontaneously as the disk brought magnetic fields into the black hole and the black hole spin wound up the field. So what we'd like to do is understand these jets. So you can repeat this simulation a number of times. Each time you can change the disk thickness, you can change the black hole spin, you can put in different magnetic fields. But here's the main result I want to note. You do the simulation over and over, and you just change how fast the black hole is spinning. And sure enough, you find how the jet power scales with spin. It's consistent with the observational data. It's consistent with a very nice analytical model from the 1970s called the Blanford-Zaniak model for how jets are powered. It's off by an overall normalization of a factor of a few from the Blanford-Zaniak prediction. And I could go into detail about where that factor of a few comes from, but I won't do it in this talk. And essentially, the rule from the Blanford-Zaniak model, which fits the data so well, is jet power has this very simple form. Omega H is angular velocity of the horizon, and phi is the flux, the amount of magnetic flux threading one hemisphere of the horizon. So you get this nice quadratic scaling with spin. But these simulations are a huge mess, so even though you get this scaling out at the end of the day, the concern that I really want to worry about is what's the underlying physics that creates this scaling, what's actually going on in the simulations that drives this, so where is the energy actually coming from? And that's where the membrane paradigm turns out to be really, really useful. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to consider this simulation here. This corresponds to a spin parameter of 0.9, if that means anything. So roughly 90% of the speed of light is how fast the black hole is spinning. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take the simulation, I'm going to zoom in right on the black hole, and I'm going to reformulate the simulation data in this membrane paradigm. So if I do that, I zoom in right on the black hole, I take the electromagnetic fields in the simulation, one thing I can do is I can compute the membrane currents that I defined earlier. So this is the same formula I showed earlier for the currents that live in this membrane. So I take the electromagnetic fields in the simulation, I take their normal component, and I restrict it to the horizon in just the right way, and you end up with this picture. So this is the membrane in this simulation. With the data has been averaged over time and averaged over azimuth to make it look nice and smooth. The currents run from north to south along the membrane. Electric currents. Yep. It looks kind of funny at the equator. It looks like the current's bumping into itself. What's really happening is the current flows along the membrane, then out into the accretion disk, and loops around and comes back through the jet in the pool. So it forms closed loops like that. Okay, so that's what the membrane current looks like in these simulations. The fact that it runs north to south is well understood. There's a simple argument why it had to be that way. In addition to this current, there's also radial magnetic fields threading this black hole. So in the same simulation, there's these currents, there's magnetic fields. And so you have J cross B torques acting on this membrane. And the torques act against the direction of the spin to slow down the membrane and extract its energy. So once you have the membrane J and you know B, you can compute these J cross B torques and work out the energy flux, the energy going into and out of the membrane. So this is the same simulation. Here's what the data looks like for the energy fluxes due to these torques. And the fluxes are, the color is such that orange and yellow means energy is coming out, and blue means energy is going into the membrane. And so these orange torques are just these J cross B torques extracting the membrane's energy, drawing it out into the jet. The blue is the accretion disk. So the accretion disk is at the equator is adding energy into the membrane. So if this was a neutron star, you could stop here. You could say that the jet power is just what I showed you on the previous slide. That's the energy that goes out and powers the jet. Black holes are a little more complicated in a sense. So a neutron star is a perfect conductor, but the membrane of the black hole is not a perfect conductor. It has a resistivity, which you work out, and it turns out to be 377 ohms. So to actually get the final answer of the energy that ends up in the jet, you can't stop at just computing the torque. you have to add a dissipation. And so the formula you need is exactly the first law of black hole thermodynamics. So this guy is the thing I showed you on the previous slide, the energy that the torques are generating. But not all that energy actually escapes the membrane and goes out into the jet. Some of it's dissipated right in the membrane. So this is Hawking temperature times black hole entropy. And that tells you the energy that actually survives to go out and power the jet. So your first thought might be to look at this and say, well, Hawking temperature is some minuscule thing with no astrophysical relevance. So surely I can throw this away. But it's true that Hawking temperature is some minuscule thing astrophysically, but black hole entropy is enormous. So this product is actually finite, and if you don't include it, you get the wrong answer. It's comparable to this term. So if you were somebody who said, you know, Hawking was crazy, there's no Hawking temperature, and you threw these away, your black hole jet powers would be off by a factor of two. So I just think it's amusing that it's a case where you can talk about the Hawking temperature and astrophysical data, and you're not crazy. I'm just trying to be a little amusing. But it's true that that term contributes a factor of two. You need to include it. And in this context, that term is basically the resistivity of the membrane, 377 ohms, which you were times J squared, where J is the membrane current that I already showed you. OK, so to get the final answer, I need to compute that term, which I can do for the same simulation. So here's what I already showed you, the energy coming out in the torques. I go to the simulation, I compute this dissipation term, and you get this figure on the right. OK, so a couple things to note about this guy. One is that it's comparable in magnitude. So I've used the same color scale on both plots. Another comment is, unlike the energy flow from torques, dissipation always positive. So dissipation is only ever adds energy to the membrane. It never takes it out. And that's just the second law of thermodynamics, black hole thermodynamics.
Is it only due to current, or dissipation due to matter?
That's a great point. So it's due to both. And actually, I am showing both. Up here in the poles where it's the, I'm going to actually make that distinction on the next slide. Up here, you're seeing eta J squared. But here there's a contribution from hydrodynamics, where the accretion disk is. And I'll show that on the next slide. It's good observation. Yeah, so always positive, had to be that way, second law of black hole thermodynamics. So to actually get the final answer, to find how much energy makes it out into the jet, you add these two plots together. And so that's the final answer. And so there is some energy flowing out into the jet. So that color means energy flowing out, but it's reduced by this dissipation term that you have to include. Yeah, and then so your question was really good. So what I'm actually showing in these plots is the, so these simulations have a gap, have electromagnetic fields, but they also have a gas. So there's also just hydrodynamics. And here I'm plotting the torques and the dissipation due to both. But as you said, it's interesting to look at them separately. So here's the same figure, but I've split them into components. So the left hemispheres show the contributions from electromagnetic fields. The right hemispheres show the contributions from just the gas in the simulation, the hydrodynamics. Couple of takeaways from this slide. One is that indeed the jets are totally powered by electric and magnetic fields. The energy in the accretion disk is all hydrodynamic, so electromagnetic fields are not very important in the disk. Hydrodynamic torques are everywhere positive. So they're everywhere adding energy to the membrane. It didn't have to be that way. The original Penrose process is an example how just with gas particles you can extract energy, but that's not happening here. The gas itself is not extracting energy anywhere. Another thing you could think about is people have come up with models where the electromagnetic fields in the accretion disk extract energy, and instead of putting it in the jets, they put it into the accretion disk. But that's also not really happening here. Electromagnetic fields are not extracting any energy into the accretion disk. So that gives you the jet power. Digging a little deeper into this membrane paradigm, can look at some other quantities. So for this, again, just hammering away at the same simulation, here's what the electromagnetic fields living in this membrane look like. There's actually no new information on this slide. Let me tell you what I mean. So the membrane acts like a resistor. It satisfies an Ohm's law that says J, the current is sigma times electric field. And I'm working in units where sigma is 1. So this should look like the plot of the current that I showed you earlier. And that's just enforced by the Ohm's law that the membrane satisfies. So J and E are the exact same thing. in the membrane. And further, and so here's, and then the magnetic field goes around like this from east to west. That also had to be that way. The metric at the horizon enforces an ingoing boundary condition that forces E cross B to just be this ingoing unit vector. So B has to look like this. It has the same magnitude as E everywhere, and it sits at right angles to it. So there's actually no new information on this slide, but it's interesting to know why. Ohm's law fixes E from the current, and then the ingoing boundary condition forces B to be what it is. The potential at the horizon is a constant.
Sure, just not coming back to the potential goes to zero.
There might be, I'd have to think about it. I know there's this, I think it's something of, it's like a perfect conductor, it's not a totally perfect conductor. I'd have to think about the answer more. I think it's probably some subtlety of what coordinates we're working in. Certainly some observers will see electric fields at the horizon. An infalling observer will see an electric field at the horizon because it's not. And we're working in this. Okay, well, let's think about. Yeah, and we're working in this ZAMO, this frame of these ZAMO observers who sit at the horizon, these fiducial observers, and I'd have to think about. I don't have an answer off the top of my head.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. But
you're in the frame, but you're in the frame where you're staying at fixed distance from the horizon.
Co-rotating with the horizon.
Co-rotating at fixed distance.
This local frame. The typical frame people use in the membrane paradigm is what I'm plotting these in, the ZAMO frame, these ZAMO observers. Well, I mean, it should. There's some cognitive dissonance at least. I mean, there should be because I think you agree that there's a current on the membrane, and the membrane has an Ohm's law, so there's going to be an electric field, given my Ohm's law. There's something we have to sort out for this other idea that there should never be an electric field there. Yeah, I'd have to sort it out after, because I haven't thought about that question before. Last thing I'll show about this topic before moving on is So the other thing, the very first thing I showed you how to compute in the membrane paradigm was if you have an electric field, the normal component defines an electric charge density on the membrane. In these simulations, the electric charge density on the membrane works out to just be zero everywhere. And the magnetic, similarly, if you have radial magnetic fields, you can define a magnetic monopole charge density on the horizon. And the simulations give you this sort of distribution. So this is new information. This is something people didn't know until you just kind of ran the simulations and looked at what the accretion disk set up. One thing that you can spot by eye is, okay, the sign is different in the northern and southern hemispheres because field lines go in one and come out the other. So sure enough, if you integrate this, there's zero net magnetic monopole charge on the black hole. The electric charge density, once you knew this, has to be zero because of something called a force-free condition, which I guess I won't explain. So this like Hawking temperature is also amusing because this is a case where if you take the membrane paradigm seriously, it's a case where you can talk about magnetic monopoles in astrophysics and also not be crazy because they also appear here and play a role. So that's what that looks like. These things living on the membrane. And then I think this is the last thing I'll say about this is you can so I've been hammering away at this one simulation. You can repeat the simulation with different black hole spins. And sure enough, everything ramps up with spin. So here's four different simulations. This is the one I've been showing you over and over and over. I'm just plotting the energy extracted by the torques, and sure enough, things go up with spin. If the black hole is not spinning, so this is just the Schwarzschild case, then this omega H is zero. And so, you can't get any energy out of a Schwarzschild black hole by torquing it, of course.
It looks like most of the energy that's emitted is at tropical
Not at the pole itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so even if you looked at the, okay, actually I have it on the next slide. So even if you look at the jet, actually, you see that most of the energy is along the edges. So it's not obviously inconsistent. And I think the explanation is that it's a lever arm effect. So to get a large torque, you want to have a large lever arm. So when you write down the torque more carefully, it has to do with the cylindrical radius that you're pushing on. And so the torque actually goes to zero right at the poles. So I think the explanation. Okay, so what I've hoped to convince you in that part of the talk was that the membrane paradigm is really, really useful for astrophysics. It's very helpful to understand where these plots come from and what's actually driving the energy extraction at the horizon. Okay, so yeah, so I mentioned at the beginning there's this hope that, you know, membrane paradigm is also seems to have connections to fundamental physics. And, you know, recent years have seen all these great advances in holography and ADS-CFT and emergent gravity and all these things that seem really related to black holes. So it seems like there's room for more interactions between astrophysics, black hole astrophysics, and fundamental physics. Recently, trying to realize some of that potential a little bit led me to go back and look at this old astrophysics problem related to something called the black hole Meissner effect. So let me explain this. This was observed in the 1970s. People were thinking about black hole jets still. And they thought about putting a black hole in a uniform vertical magnetic field. And then they looked at what happened as they spun up the black hole. And they found that the amount of magnetic flux through the horizon dropped as the spin increased. And so severely that if they pushed the spin up to the extremal limit, the field completely was expelled from the black hole. The flux went totally to zero. Field lines go around the horizon. OK, so that was their observation. Interesting for at least two reasons. One is astrophysics. I just explained that this standard model of how jets are powered invokes magnetic torques acting on the membrane. So you need these J cross B forces. But if this Meissner effect kicks in and totally expels the field at high spins, your B goes to zero at the horizon. So your torque turns off. So the concern has always been that if this operates in nature, it could kill jets at high spins. So that's a concern that people have still been worrying about, whether this causes jet power to turn over and maybe go to zero at extremal spins because this Meissner effect expels the field. And the second reason the Meissner effect is interesting is because it looks like something that is, it looks deep. It looks like it's connected to fundamental physics. It's of course called the black hole Meissner effect because it looks at least qualitatively like the ordinary Meissner effect of a superconductor. So it's well known that if you take a superconducting material like tin and you cool it down, it expels magnetic fields. So this picture on the left is tin below 3 Kelvin. It's an actual picture of an experiment with a lump of tin and the magnetic field lines going around it. And then the one on the right is a black hole that I made on my laptop with one of these solutions with a vertical field. And it's spinning at the extremal limit, and the field was expelled. And you can, amusingly, you know, to make the analogy look a little more suggestive, spinning up a black hole is the same as lowering its Hawking temperature. So as you spin it up, its Hawking temperature drops. And at the extremal limit, the Hawking temperature hits zero. So you can say that both systems, when you cool them down, tend to expel magnetic fields. One comment is there's a whole huge literature now on holographic superconductors. That's a different problem. That requires, essentially, you're in asymptotically ADS. And It's a different literature. This is just a Kerr black hole in asymptotically flat space spun up. It expels the field. So it's different from that. And so, yeah, so there's these two things. One question is, what's going on? Over the years, there's now many examples of this black hole Meissner effect phenomenon. People have checked that it works for different kinds of black holes. So you can, instead of spin, you can have a charged black hole. And you charge it up to the extremal limit. And sure enough, it does the same thing. You can do it in different numbers of dimensions. Another thing is it does not just magnetic fields, but also electric fields are expelled. So there's many examples. But there surprisingly has not been a nice unifying explanation of the phenomenon that feels deep enough to, you know, count as an explanation. And then there's this other question, which is, what does it have to do with astrophysics? Does it kill jets at high spins? And it's something that's still been debated. There's still a camp that believes that at high spins, jets must turn off because of this effect expelling the field. So I guess in the rest of the talk, I'm going to talk about those two questions. So one way of understanding the Meissner effect is geometrical. So spinning black holes have long throats. What I mean is, if you look at an embedding diagram, so you can think of this this cone as the equatorial plane with the horizon sitting down here, and as I move up along the cone, I'm moving out to larger and larger radii. If you compute these embedding diagrams for different black hole spins, you find that the length of this funnel gets longer and longer, such that at extremal spins, there's an infinitely long funnel. And so one explanation of the Meissner effect is that as you put magnetic fields in this geometry, the magnetic field line wants to dip down this funnel, and it gets diluted as it falls towards the black hole down this funnel, so much so that at extremal spins, the field line has to stretch an infinite proper distance, and it's infinitely diluted, and so that's why the field strength goes to zero at the horizon. So that's one sort of intuitive picture people have used to explain the black hole Meissner effect. It's very geometrical. It looks nothing like the ordinary Meissner effect of superconductivity. So one might want a reformulation of this that brings it closer to something you'd see in a condensed matter textbook, something more quantum. So here's a thought. Over the past couple of years, there's been a lot of literature about how geometry and the lengths of these throats is related to entanglement. So people in this room all probably have heard of this recent ER equals EPR proposal, which says that the lengths of these black hole throats has to do with how much entanglement there is between modes outside the horizon and modes inside the horizon. And such that if you decrease the amount of entanglement, the horizon, these throats or space-time tends to stretch out. And if you increase the entanglement, space-time tends to knit itself back together. So there's this proposal that's been floating around for the past couple of years that geometry and entanglement have this relationship. But also the black hole throat is related to the length of this throat. So the black hole Meissner effect. So the idea is maybe there's a way to relate the black hole Meissner effect directly to entanglement. So let me describe how you could do that. These are out of order. How much time do I have? I'll just skip these. So here's a way you could get the black hole Meissner effect. Not thinking about the geometrical picture, but just trying to get it directly from a more quantum picture. And then after I explain that, I'll tell you why I think this is kind of nice. So here's one way I've thought about it. So think about some double-sided horizon. So you're supposed to think of like the Penrose diagram of an eternal black hole as one example. So everyone knows, so you have these two horizons. You have a black hole interior region, white hole interior, and these two left and right exterior regions. And then you can imagine that this thing is in the thermal field double state, which is sort of the natural vacuum for this setup. And it's characterized by an inverse temperature beta. And so for now, the extremal limit is going to mean beta goes to infinity, because that's cooling it down to zero temperature, which is the same as if this was, say, a Kerr black hole, it would be spinning it up to the extremal limit. So we want to think about how this thermal field double state looks as we send beta to infinity. In particular, the first thing you can compute in this thermal field double state is you can think about two-point correlations between excitations in the left side and the right side. And you find that if you compute the two-point correlation function in this thermal field double state, and then you take the limit as you cool the state down to zero or send beta to infinity, so this extremal limit, two-point correlations between the left and right wedges go to zero. So that's just an observation about, that's just a property of this thermal field state that follows from the physics. And then the next thing you can do to bring it closer to the Meissner effect is you can push the point in the left wedge you can push it over to the horizon and conclude that by taking that limit, that excitations, that the two-point function between points on the horizon and points in the right exterior, those vanish in the extremal limit. And then once you have that observation in hand, just from thinking about the thermal field double state and how its correlations and entanglement behaves, once you have that observation, it's not too far to see the black hole Meissner effect. So think about putting some currents outside a black hole, and you want to know what is the gauge field on the horizon. And so the way I'd solve that problem in classical physics is I'd write down my currents, I'd find the Green's function from Maxwell's equation, and then I'd integrate the currents against the Green's function, and that would give me the gauge field on the horizon. But I can also think about this Green's function more quantum mechanically as the two-point function of a free Maxwell field. And I know just from general properties of this thermal field double state that in the extremal limit, these correlations have to go to zero. So this thing has to go to zero if I evaluate it between points on the horizon and points off the horizon. So it gives you this sort of very general way to see that in the extremal limit, if you put currents outside the black hole, the gauge field on the horizon has to become zero. And all of these statements are up to gauge transformation, so pure gauge. And then so obviously when you compute the magnetic flux threading the horizon, that's going to be zero too. And OK, so it's just a rewriting of the black hole Meissner effect. But it doesn't make any reference to the length of the black hole throat. It looks more quantum mechanical, and I think it came from thinking about some new things floating around in the physics literature, and I think it has some nice features. So let me mention a few nice properties of thinking about the black hole Meissner effect this way. One is that it makes it really easy to see generalizations of the effect. So it hadn't been pointed out before. It had not been pointed out before, but that argument, it doesn't matter whether those horizons I drew were black hole or Rindler or de Sitter horizons. And so the same argument applies to all of them. And when I first thought of that, I thought that doesn't make any sense. Surely there's no Meissner effect in Rindler space. But of course, I mean, actually, it's a good consistency check to think it through. So cooling down Rindler space to the extremal limit, lowering the temperature to zero, means decelerating the observer. And so as you take that limit, as you decelerate to zero, the Rindler horizon moves out to infinity. So of course, if your Rindler observer is carrying some currents with them, then the magnetic flux through the Rindler horizon from those currents is going to go to zero in that limit, just because the horizon has been pushed out to infinity. I mean, of course, the horizon is an infinite plane, so the net flux through the Rindler horizon stays constant, but through any finite patch goes to zero. And so you start to see this black hole Meissner effect has these other manifestations in these other spaces. Of course, the Rindler and de Sitter examples are sort of trivial. The black hole case is the most interesting and subtle one. I don't have time to go into it. I skipped the slides earlier, but there's this other astrophysics question about evading. Can you get around the black hole Meissner effect? There are a couple of loopholes that let you get around it and continue to thread the black hole with flux in the extremal limit. And those loopholes are important for astrophysics because they let you continue to have jets even at extremal spin. And this derivation, if you'll call it that, of the Meissner effect gives you another way of understanding those loopholes and spotting them. And then the other thing is, since it has more of a quantum flavor than the geometrical explanation, it lets you see the similarities and differences with the ordinary Meissner effect better. Let me close with a couple comments about that. So the question I started out with a year ago is I wanted to know, is this black hole Meissner effect just the real Meissner effect of superconductors in disguise? Maybe the membrane is in some sense a superconductor. Is there something we've missed? Is there another way of looking at this problem where they really become the same thing? And I'll spend a slide or two on it, but the punchline is, I mean, no, I think they really are just basically different physics that just look the same. But here's what I mean by that statement. So the ordinary Meissner effect we understand really well. The punchline is it's caused by gauge symmetry breaking. So when you go below the critical temperature, the gauge symmetry is broken in the superconductor. So the field acquires a mass and it's energetically favorable for it to be expelled, et cetera. And so so you could ask, is the black hole Meissner effect also related to gauge symmetry breaking in some sense. Is there any sense in which this extremal black hole is breaking gauge symmetry? Okay, and so it turns out they're connected a little bit, but not in the right way. They're sort of connected in the opposite way that they should be if this was the normal Meissner effect. And to go into this, I'd appeal to some papers from the 90s by Balachandran and collaborators. So he made some really interesting observations that I don't think have really been followed up enough, so I'll just sort of advertise them. He had a different way of trying to derive the black hole membrane paradigm, where gauge invariance is front and center. So this is Balachandran's derivation of the membrane paradigm. He says, okay, so instead of that cartoon I showed you at the start with electric fields threading the horizon, he says, I'm going to use different variables. I'm going to think about Wilson loops. So normal observer, infalling observer sees their variables are Wilson loops. These are gauge invariant. But then I think about the guy who stays outside the black hole, throws away the black hole interior. And that process, you throw away part of the Wilson loop. So some of these Wilson loops become Wilson lines, which are no longer gauge invariant. Everyone knows that if you shift this by a gauge transformation, this guy doesn't care, but this guy does. And so, so in some sense, Balachandran would say horizons break gauge invariance. And to restore gauge invariance, you need to introduce edge states. He draws analogies with condensed matter physics. And the edge states that you need to put on the horizon to restore gauge invariance is exactly the membrane paradigm. And so that's his starting point. So in some sense, he would say horizons break gauge invariance. But something funny happens in the extremal limit. So in the extremal limit, we talked about how the gauge, in the extremal limit, you have this special relationship where because of the stretching of the throat, if you like, or whatever, however you want to describe it, the gauge field on the horizon vanishes. It becomes pure gauge. So this problem in the previous slide no longer happens. And so you don't need edge states. You don't need you can just set all the membrane charges to zero, which is the same as saying that there's no flux threading the horizon. Because if there was flux threading the horizon, then you'd have some magnetic monopoles. And so I just wanted to say that in a sort of hand-wavy way, you can say that there's a sense in which horizons break gauge invariance, but in the extremal limit, gauge invariance is in some sense restored, actually. You don't need membrane charges anymore to patch it up. And so it's kind of funny that it ends up being the opposite of what it is in superconductors. Ordinary Meissner effect happens because you break gauge invariance in the low temperature limit. Here, in a certain sense, you restore it, and that causes this black hole Meissner effect that you don't need to put membrane charges. To summarize, membrane paradigm has a foot in fundamental physics and a foot in astrophysics, and so I think I just want to sell this idea that there might be opportunities for more interactions between the two. In the middle part of the talk, I tried to convince you that membrane paradigm has definitely proven its usefulness to explain the astrophysics of black hole jets. And then in the last part, I wanted to suggest that I could take this idea further and suggest to you that some recent ideas in the physics literature give a bit of insight into some old astrophysics problems. So I'll stop there. Yeah, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek. So you could cancel. At the end of the day, there's this term THDSH. You could cancel all the H bars and end up with surface gravity dA. And so you never see the Hawking temperature by itself. You only see it in this combination. And so no, like you shouldn't award the Nobel Prize to Stephen Hawking because we used that formula for astrophysics. Because we really just use surface gravity times dA. But there's no reason you can't put in the factors. And I think it's useful for intuition to think of it as an honest-to-God thermodynamic dissipation. But if you insist that you don't believe in Hawking, you can get around it. Yeah.
You said that it's comparable to the other.
Yeah. The physical origin, as I said, in the membrane paradigm, when you want to compute the dissipation, you find this term resistivity times J squared. And you just have to trust me that with a lot of rewriting, you can rewrite it as this, using a lot of identities. Yeah, the interpretation is that as I'm doing all of this, there's so here's the interpretation. So yeah, by interpretation, I think you mean like, how do I think about this without using the membrane paradigm at all? And so that you can do this whole problem that way. Yeah, the point is that this energy extraction, a black hole has a mass and it has an irreducible mass. I'm extracting energy and lowering the mass. Irreducible mass stays fixed. I'm not allowed to violate the second law of black hole thermodynamics. The area of the horizon through these extraction processes always increases. Even though the mass of the black hole is going down, the area is always increasing. And like that's just a theorem that has to happen. And so even though energy is coming out, the area is increasing. And so, yeah, and so when you compute the energy coming out, you can just compute it or you can split it in these two terms. And so it's what am I trying to say? It's this has to go up. And so you can write some people like to write these equations without this physical interpretation of them, but you'll always see this term.
Okay. It's what it comes down to. Resistivity of a black hole does not depend on your model of what's going on outside.
No. Yeah, it's not dissipation outside in the accretion disk or something. It's an intrinsic resistivity on the horizon. Yeah. Yep.
Just, I mean, that kind of thought about how you might try to revive the connection between ordinary superconductivity and this. It's just that ordinary thing, the ordinary argument about why normal superconductor expels after gauge integrating, predicated on the idea that the photon gets a positive mass.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, here, I mean, you know, if you imagine somehow the particles sitting on the horizon, right inside the horizon, statically, then they would have, you know, negative energy instead of positive energy.
I see what you're saying.
Somehow there's the fact that there's a sign flip inside the horizon could be, now that you mention it, but I mean.
That's an interesting thought. If one could make that precise, maybe then you could put the two on the same page and say they're not more analogous. Yeah, it's interesting.
I'd like to be the annoying guy and take issue with the statement that the membrane paradigm is useful. So you've done some very sensible things.
Uh-huh.
Right? You said it's a good idea to look at the local energy flux through the horizon.
Yeah.
It's a good idea to express it in terms of the gravitational and electromagnetic fields on the horizon.
Yeah.
It's a good idea to plot those fields on nice colorful spheres and so on. What's not obvious is why it's also a good idea to change the names of all those fields, the electric field on the horizon, the magnetic field on the horizon, and rename them into charge current and so on. What do we gain from that?
I mean, let's see. So how do I want to answer this? Yeah. I will just tell you that you can look at if it's in some level a matter of taste. If you can look at there's other papers on the same problem that avoid using any membrane paradigm language. I find a lot of intuition is lost because you have a lot of equations with when you, in the membrane paradigm, suddenly all these equations, each term has a really nice physical interpretation. When I try to do the same problem without, I don't see why I shouldn't let myself use this extra physical intuition I get by thinking, oh, that's this. So some people will never think of this as TDS or call it a dissipation, but for me, it's helpful. Like I see each of these terms, it's very helpful to have in my head the physical interpretation of each one. And then secondly, I think, so it's just useful on a practical level. And then I think there's something really deep about it as well. This idea that you, as someone who doesn't jump in the black hole, there might be, okay, so this is still being debated and so on, but there might be deeper quantum reasons why they're really not allowed to talk about the black hole interior. Because if you try to put the black hole interior and the exterior on the same footing, people have found all these paradoxes about no cloning and monogamy of entanglement, which you know as well as anyone. And so I think there's also a deep reason why you really should throw away the black hole interior and not be allowed to talk about it for quantum reasons. And once you do that, the membrane paradigm and all these weird new definitions are sort of forced upon you for consistency. Yeah, it's true also historically. This is a good historical point that this reminds me of. So before the black hole jet models in the 1970s, astrophysicists built models of pulsars, pulsar jets. And so a pulsar is a neutron star. So it has it really has a nice Bollinger neutron. And so a historical reason for the membrane paradigm was astrophysicists wanted to take these pulsar models and just carbon copy them for black holes. And so the membrane paradigm was largely developed by astrophysicists to solve that problem. And it was certainly historically very helpful. Yeah. Because they could make this precise analogy with pulsars. Something called the Goldreich-Julian model is basically just turned Goldreich-Julian model for pulsars plus membrane paradigm gives you Blanford's and Eyck model for black holes is basically the history.
Yeah.
So
I agree with everything, and on the quantum level, you really need to rethink. But classically, still, what's happening here is just that we're saying, oh, well, you know, we just have better intuition about hydrodynamics than about boundary conditions in GR.
That's what I'm telling you. There's camps in astrophysics right now. There's people who refuse to touch the membrane paradigm for the reason you said, because they think it makes them a more hardcore relativist if they don't use it. But it has all these weird properties. Like the membrane has these teleological response functions where it responds before you perturb it. And that turns people off. That was the comment made earlier about I think it could be some deep lesson there. Something interesting that deserves to be understood better. All different answers to that question. But the historically, if you're just interested in this practical question, historically it led to new advances. People saw connections. So Luis is working on a problem right now where he has a black hole moving through a magnetic field, and the magnetic field extracts the linear momentum of the black hole. And he and I have been thinking about that problem. And it's very useful to think about that problem using the membrane paradigm, because people have already worked out what happens if you move a conducting sphere through a magnetic field. I'm not saying you shouldn't learn GR really well and learn how to do things without it, but why not learn? You could say the same thing about ADS-CFT. You could say, why use the CFT? Just be a relativist and do everything in ADS. All dualities are at some level just tautologies. It's difficult. Here's the thing. So how the Meissner effect works depends on the field geometry you put on the black hole and how it turns off. For the simple, just original example from the 70s of a uniform vertical field, the field is expelled very gradually and gradually goes to zero. So it would be a gradual thing that you'd see it all spins. But the effect really kicks in and really becomes severe really close to spin one. And so, the observational data is too noisy. There's only a couple points up there near extremal spin. Too noisy to say much. It's something you could look for, though, I think, in coming years, is you could keep an eye on those points and see how they behave. In the simulation data I showed you, the highest spin was spin 0.98. By then, I would think if the Meissner effect was operating, you'd start to see it, and you don't. And all the simulations, mine and others, just show spin power going up with spin, never turning over and coming down. And the loophole is subtle, but roughly the loophole is all this picture of the black hole Meissner effect is you put some currents outside the black hole, and then you look at the fields they source at the horizon. The argument I showed you with two-point functions and so on, that was the picture. In the simulations, you have current extending all the way down to and through the horizon. And so, is that expelled? Well, it turns out, if there's certain field geometries, you can get away with it. So, there are loopholes, and simulations seem to choose the simulations where you don't force anything, just seem to pick those loopholes. Yeah. The Meissner effect just cares about the current distribution. So if your gas moves the currents around, it could move them into a configuration where there's no Meissner effect. But a more interesting answer is another loophole to the Meissner effect is it doesn't work for non-stationary fields. And so an early sort of surprising example people found was they were thinking about the Meissner effect, and they found exact solutions for a black hole in a uniform field. But the uniform field is not aligned with the spin axis. It's tilted. And if you have a tilted field, it's no longer a stationary field. And you zoom in on the solution near the horizon, you find out that it's becoming radiative near the horizon. And that lets you evade the Meissner effect. So non-state. So the Meissner effect really only expels stationary magnetic fields. However, black.
What?
No. So yeah, that's true in a technical sense, but all the analytical black hole jet models assume something stationary. It's true that these simulations are messy and turbulent, but you can understand the jets show up in just the time averaged fields, and so you assume the non-stationary isn't essential for black hole jets. You can build stationary models, Stationary electromagnetic fields can torque membranes and extract their energy. And those sorts of stationary fields are the ones that at least the standard jet models use. Those are the ones we think are operating in nature. So that is a loophole, non-stationary fields, but it's probably not, it's not the loophole nature uses, I would say. Yeah, not very much tomorrow.
Thank you.